At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Technology, housing, and the federal debt on the broadcast today. Yes, sometimes it feels like the news never does change, doesn't it? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Wake up to the day's top business headlines. Subscribe to the Marketplace Morning Report podcast. It's on iTunes and marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. It's Wednesday, the 20th of April. Glad to have you with us today. To those who've been saying there's a tech bubble lurking out there somewhere, well, you might have a point. This week has brought us a boom time earnings season for some big name technology companies. Intel, IBM, and Yahoo all posted strong profits yesterday. Apple came out this afternoon with numbers that can only boggle the mind. $24.5 billion in revenue for the quarter. $6 billion of that pure profit. So we got Marketplace's Steve Henn on the phone and asked him to poke around and find out whether these numbers might mean that consumers and big businesses are finally starting to behave like the recession is behind us.
For companies like Intel, IBM, and Cisco, the credit crisis was rough. Their biggest customers, the biggest corporations in the world, were scared to death of spending money.
Customers were hoarding cash and delaying purchases as long as possible.
Dan Olds is a tech analyst at the Gabriel Consulting Group.
Companies are feeling strong enough with their cash hoards, with their market position, to be able to start loosening up the purse strings and doing some long-delayed technology refreshes.
This quarter, profits at Intel rose almost 30%. Even the company's executives were surprised by demand for Intel's chips. But tech analyst Darren Karas believes there's more going on here than simple pent-up demand.
You know, we're seeing a lot of very, very exciting innovations that I think are, you know, going to continue to drive tech spending and tech growth.
Sure, sleek gadgets like the iPad are luring consumers back to the market, but the real action is overseas. Karas was just in India. He thinks that new wireless networks there, combined with cheaper smartphones, could bring 120 million new internet users online in that country in the next few years.
Anybody who is looking at what's going on in tech right now and really needs to understand the implications of this kind of globalization of technology.
Consumer devices are getting lighter and cheaper. Millions now connect on phones and tablets, and that's a boon for Apple and Android. But it also means big corporate computers and servers will need to carry heavier loads. And that's a boon for companies like Intel, too. In Silicon Valley, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
Now to the little sector that helped bring the world's biggest economy to its knees. That'd be the U.S. housing market, of course. The typical spring buying season hasn't been all that typical so far this year, but there was a glimmer of improvement today. Sales of existing homes rose more than expected in March, and demand for the mortgages to buy those homes got a boost as well, up about 10%, the highest mark this year for mortgage demand. So, is the housing market finally working its way out of the woods? Maybe. Here's Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith.
Home sales out today show the housing market is improving in a slow and steady kind of way. Kenneth Rosen chairs the Fisher Center for Real Estate at UC Berkeley.
They're getting slightly better, but not as strong as they could be given how favorable market conditions are for buying.
What he means is low interest rates and depressed home prices. What's holding the market back? Rosen says there's a lot of anxiety from buyers that prices will keep falling. And even people who are ready to take the plunge might not qualify for a mortgage loan.
There's a lot of people who would like to buy a house. Credit is so tight today, they can't.
Last month, more than a third of home sales were all cash deals, which is a sign that investors, not families, are taking advantage of the low prices. Still, Denver realtor John Lawrence says he's starting to see traditional buyers reappear.
In the last couple of months, we've seen a lot of activity, a lot more buyers are ready to look now. In fact, in the last week, we've seen a huge number of contracts.
Lawrence says the problem now is sellers. The glut of foreclosed homes on the market is pushing prices down. Software developer Chris Allen and his wife have been house shopping in Albany, New York for more than a year. He says finding a mid-range home is almost impossible.
From 200,000 and below and 600,000 above, there's plenty of homes out there. It's really the middle is what I'm seeing is a drought, almost like a donut. There's a lot of stuff on the outer rings, but nothing in the middle.
Allen has been pre-approved for a mortgage, and he's poised to pounce.
There is a time where you just break down and just say, you know, the next house I see, I'm buying it.
In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
Take today's technology news, sprinkle in that upbeat housing vibe, and you got yourself a winner, ladies and gentlemen. All three major indices were up today. The Dow is back where it was 3 years ago. Or if you put it another way, the Dow hasn't moved in about 3 years. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. All was basically quiet on the debt limit front today. Not too much political back and forth over how to manage the national finances. That will surely change in the weeks to come, and we will be desperate for a break from the politics of government economics. But in the meantime, commentator Robert Reich wonders why the debate is political in the first place.
As the government approaches its borrowing limit of $14.3 trillion, Republican and Democratic leaders are jockeying for political advantage over what conditions should be attached to raising that limit. This is insane. Raising the debt limit should not be subject to party politics. It's bad enough government shutdowns have become an accepted part of political negotiation, but failure to increase the amount the Treasury can borrow would have far graver results. Not only would the government be unable to issue Social Security or Medicare checks, but the United States couldn't pay interest on its current debt. We'd go into default. The full faith and credit of the United States would be in jeopardy. Treasury bonds would go into freefall. Interest rates would skyrocket. We and most of the rest of the world would fall into financial chaos. The recovery is still fragile. All this would force us and most of the rest of the world into a deep recession or worse. No one in their right mind would threaten this, and yet it's talked about as if it's just another aspect of Washington politics that may happen in early July when the Treasury runs out of ways to keep paying our debts. In fact, it's a giant game of highway chicken, and if one driver doesn't yield, the crash will be catastrophic. Games of chicken are won by drivers able to convince their opponents they won't swerve. That gives a strategic advantage to Republicans backed by the so-called Tea Party, who are so convinced government is evil, they've signaled they'd be willing to risk it all. But this shouldn't be a matter of political strategy. Disagreements about the nation's budget should be worked out through the constitutional process of majority votes in Congress, followed by the president's signature or veto, and Congress's right to override the veto. No group of legislators is entitled to threaten to crash the United States economy if its demands aren't met. Where are the leaders of Wall Street? Where are the corporate statesmen? They all have as much, if not more, to lose as anyone. They should insist this game of chicken be called off.
Robert Reich was Secretary of Labor for President Clinton. His most recent book is called Aftershock, The Next Economy and America's Future. David Frum is up in the rotation next week. Send us your comments sometime before that, please. Marketplace.org. Click on the link that says contact. The headline news from the Middle East recently has been Libya, of course, but the economics of the region are helping the protests spread to the north and to the east. Syrian President Bashar al-Assad announced an end to a 50-year-old emergency law yesterday. It gave the government almost unlimited powers to put down dissent. Protesters aren't buying it, though. Anti-government demonstrations continued across that country today. There's one planned for Friday that could see the biggest turnout so far. Fred Lawson teaches government at Mills College in Oakland, California. He's written about and studied Syria for years, and we've got him on the line. Fred Lawson, good to have you with us.
Pleasure to be here.
Give us the thumbnail sketch, would you, as we get going here, of the Syrian economy. What drives it and what, if anything, keeps it going?
Syria has a comparatively diversified economy. Unlike some countries of the Middle East and unlike the paradigmatic oil-producing countries, Syria has a relatively large manufacturing sector. It has agriculture. It has trade. And it even had a little bit of oil up until recent years.
So these protests that are happening now, are they economically the same as the ones in Egypt and Tunisia that we've seen across the region with large numbers of unemployed youth, with little economic opportunity for advancement? I mean, is that what's happening?
That's an important component of what's happening, I think. One part of the economic underlay is that where the revolts first broke out in Syria were provincial areas that are relatively poor, even compared to other parts of Syria. I'm very intrigued by what's taking place in Homs right at the moment, because Homs, which is the new center of the opposition, is an old line industrial town. It's the place where many of the state factories were set up. It has large trade union presence. And it wouldn't surprise me if some of those old trade unionists have found their state-run companies being undercut by new private sector companies, are finding their production undercut by imported products. And so the economic future in Homs may look particularly bleak right at the moment.
Is the Syrian economy state-controlled the same way that the Egyptian economy was, where the army was so involved and where to do any business there you had to sort of be in league with the government somehow?
As perhaps in Egypt, in Syria, important, powerful figures with close ties to the president have consolidated large economic empires over the last 5 or 10 years. And in that sense, there's a real overlap between these powerful individuals and government control over the economy.
What's the U.S. economic exposure in Syria? Almost none, right?
Almost none. There are severe sanctions on any U.S. commercial relations or financial relations with Syria. In a very interesting case, the Syrian National Airline is flying increasingly obsolete American aircraft and was looking desperately for spare parts and upgrading about a year, year and a half ago, and was denied any access to U.S. spare parts. And the Syrians then turned to Russian aircraft to replace the American aircraft in the Syrian National Fleet. So there's really not much contact and therefore not much leverage, economic leverage, that the United States has with Syria.
What happens if these protests are successful and President Assad is forced from office? What happens to the economy and what happens to how things run?
I think a crucial question is what might happen after the regime gets overturned with regard to outside investors. American investment has been stifled for the last 15, 20 years. European investment has been relatively low. Syria has gotten some outside investment from Kuwait and Saudi Arabia. The real question is, where might new resources come into the country if the present regime gets overturned?
Fred Lawson is a professor of government at Mills College in Oakland, California. His most recent book is one he edited. It's called Demystifying Syria. Fred, thanks a lot.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Coming up,
our number one talking point was New Orleans is 100 miles away from the coast.
Other places, though, are a whole lot closer. 1 year since the spill and a tale of two cities. But first, let's do the numbers. U.S. debt warning? Yeah, no, I don't remember that. The Dow Industrials landed a gain of 186 points today, about 1.5%. closed at 12,453. The NASDAQ surged 57 points, 0.2%, 2802 at the bell. The S&P 500 gained 17 points, about 1.3%, ended things at 1330. As we mentioned earlier, tech fueled the session. Intel shares sped up 7.8% today, tops among the Dow components. Hewlett-Packard, whose computers often use Intel chips, rose 2.25%. Apple shares gained 1.3% before the bell, and then they reported those sizzling sales figures we told you about. The biggest mover today was TiVo. Its shares soared nearly 30% after a court upheld a ruling that its digital recording technology had been infringed upon. Oddly, the infringer, satellite TV company EchoStar, saw its shares rise 2.5% today. Gotta love capitalism. You're listening to Marketplace.
Show Marketplace how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/APM Marketplace. What does Tier 1 Capital have in common with a wedding cake? Visit the Marketplace whiteboard to find out. Our videos demystify finance and economics. Just go to our website, marketplace.org.
Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. The Conference Board releases its monthly index of leading economic indicators. If you're in Iceland, you probably have time off to celebrate the first day of summer. It's a public holiday. Unable to celebrate that? Stuck at the office? Here's something for you. National High Five Day. Work on your technique today. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM, that's American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl.
I'm going to sit right down and write myself a letter.
Our letters segment this Wednesday starts with inflation. Our report at the end of last week noted that core inflation, that's the one that doesn't count food or energy costs, ticked up just 0.1% in March. We tried to explain why the government doesn't put all that much weight on the price that people pay to eat and drive, and that got Peggy Martin from Pasadena, California, a little bit depressed.
It seems the very things the government doesn't count towards their inflation rate calculations are the very things that hit me and people like me right in the gut. And of course, because there is no inflation, the amount of my SSDI check will not increase.
On now to David Frum's commentary of last week. David said that most Americans think, not me, when asked who should bear the brunt of spending cuts and balancing the budget. Among his examples of not me-ers, he included public employees in Wisconsin, which is when Jerry Grebe of Green Bay, whose husband is a teacher, decided she had to say something.
Conservative commentators have repeatedly misrepresented the dispute in Wisconsin as public workers not willing to pay their fair share, when in fact they have agreed to all the cuts Governor Walker demanded. All, not some, all. Every penny he claims is necessary to repair the budget.
Stephen Dubner and I talked conspicuous conservation on our Freakonomics segment yesterday, saving the planet but making sure everybody knows you're doing it. No small number of you wrote to protest, saying that you do good for the environment because it's what's right. But David Rhodes from Stores Connecticut and some others said economists aren't the first to figure this out.
I enjoyed the story about Prius owners in eco-sensitive towns. This is not new. Any good South Park fan remembers the Smug Alert episode in season 10. A really fun look at exactly what the researchers finally figured out.
Now there goes the new high and mighty Gerald Broflowski. Yeah, ever since he got that new hybrid, he thinks he's better than everyone else.
Dad, can we go home? All you ever do since you got this car is drive around and show it off.
Thanks, by the way, for all the love from all those lame mini-driving dads out there. I appreciate it. If you've got a comment for us, share it, marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. A year ago tonight, about 9:45 Central Time, a cloud of methane gas swept over the drilling platform Deepwater Horizon. It came from an oil leak about a mile down. The flames from the ensuing explosion were visible 35 miles away. They were just the beginning of what's been another very long year along the Gulf Coast. But how bad it was depended very much on where you were. So we sent a pair of reporters out to discover how the spill has affected two separate communities in Louisiana. Eve Tro went to the bayous down along the coast, but Adrian Hill starts us off in New Orleans.
I'm at Commander's Palace, one of New Orleans' best-known restaurants. Its menu is full of local seafood, done up fancy. The sous chef behind me is making Creole cream cheese-infused gnocchi that'll pair with fresh crawfish. The restaurant's been around since 1880, and a year ago, when the oil started spewing...
You know, April, May, June, all of us are freaking out. I mean, I had conversations with the owners, and we said to ourselves, okay, what are we going to do when we have to close?
Tori McPhail is the chef here. Now, a year later, those conversations seem premature. Really, really premature. Seafood kept coming into the restaurant, with some exceptions.
There's a huge crisis for shrimp right now because nobody's shrimping.
But McPhail says the seafood that is available is pristine, and people keep showing up to eat it.
We had a good year last year. You know, probably the best summer we've had since Katrina.
In spite of the oil spill, and perhaps in some ways because of it, 2010 for New Orleans was a bit of a boom year. The final count isn't in, but tourism officials say they had the highest number of visitors since the city flooded. The appeal, in part, is that New Orleans didn't stop to wring its hands. It just got on with life and to-dos like the Tennessee Williams Festival.
No!
And a much less highbrow gathering for people who like dressing up as pirates.
The music was still playing. You could still get amazing seafood. The architecture is as beautiful as ever. So we had to work very hard to let the public know that New Orleans was unaffected by the oil spill.
That's Jennifer Day. She's not a pirate. She is with the New Orleans Convention and Visitors Bureau. We sit outside at 10 in the morning. A musician is already playing jazz on the street corner. Day says the city's marketing and PR was helped along by $5 million in BP money.
Our number one talking point was New Orleans is 100 miles away from the coast. When you look at New Orleans, you see water surrounding the city. That is not the Gulf of Mexico. That is fresh water.
The tourism office came up with ads with slogans like, things in New Orleans are normal. Well, our normal, which is mostly true.
There were some short-term and some potential long-term benefits, if you want to call it that, of the oil spill.
Michael Hecht heads Greater New Orleans, Inc., an economic development group. He says right after the spill, businessmen and lawyers packed their best suits and moved to the city to handle oil spill-related business and lawsuits, boosting the commercial real estate market. And Hecht says the spill and Katrina before it have helped point to possible future growth for the New Orleans area economy, environmental restoration, and disaster mitigation.
Next time there's an oil spill somewhere else in the world, it shouldn't be a Dutch or a Taiwanese ship that's servicing that event. It should be a Louisiana ship.
Hecht is optimistic about what he calls sustainable industries, companies that can capitalize on New Orleans' unfortunate and extensive expertise in cleaning up. The city has options, but is still dependent on how the rest of the region fares. For more on that, I'll hand off to Eve Tro in Lafourche Parish on the Gulf Coast.
I'm about 100 miles southwest of New Orleans, in Cajun country. The economy here is the Gulf of Mexico, and getting oil and seafood out of it. At the local Swamp Stomp Festival, oil rig and shipyard worker Daryl Degg says despite the spill, people here are proud to do dangerous work.
We all know the risk. There's nothing that would make these people down here change their mind or the way they live.
But in the past year, life has changed around workers like Degg. When the rig exploded, the economy paused for cleanup. The two lanes of the main highway were packed with trucks hauling huge nylon tubes to soak up oil. Or,
you know, buses carrying workers to the beach, all of BP's equipment and operations that they were hauling in.
Lafourche Parish Information Officer Brennan Mathern, he says cleanup work paid big.
A lot of people made more money than they may have ever made in a year.
But that's pretty much over now. Mathern says local officials are just starting to measure the spill's impact and whether Lafourche Parish can still live up to its motto.
Feeding and fueling America.
This is all ice bin.
Roxy Foltz is on the feeding side.
Jake's Crab Shack.
For more than a decade, she's boxed up live crabs.
You treat them like a carton of eggs.
And ship them around the country.
At least about 10,000 pounds.
A day?
Yes.
After the spill, most crabbing waters shut down.
The areas that were open, they were being overfished.
the few crabs caught were hard to sell.
Because people didn't want Louisiana crabs. They were scared to eat them. We lost a lot of good markets.
She lost workers, too. Crab season starts next month, and only a quarter of her fishermen are back. Because no one knows if the catch will be good, worth the cost of fuel, traps, and bait. If the season is bad,
I won't be able to stay open.
Full says this summer is make or break. From their quiet vessels, some fishermen are looking down the murky bayou waters toward the Gulf, where they could get offshore oil work. That happens at Port Fouchon, a vast industrial zone of boat yards, cleaning bunkers, and helicopter pads that service rigs.
Deep water search and rescue, and that's a training mission.
Chet Chason directs Port Fouchon. He says it's still unclear how fast work will pick up on offshore oil rigs after last year's moratorium on drilling. To save jobs, port companies have transferred workers to other states or overseas or put them on busy work.
I don't think there's any more chipping and painting and sandblasting that can be done. That's what they've been having their employees do to be ready for when the permits come.
In the past year, 11 deepwater drilling permits were issued, compared to 5 per week before. Chason says thousands of jobs are on the line.
We have not been exploring and drilling new wells for new oil to continue producing the amount that we produce every day.
People in Lafourche mostly see the BP spill as one huge accident in half a century of Gulf drilling. Parish official Brennan Mathern says locals do care about the environment, but they care more about getting back to work.
We take pride in our area, and if this is what our area is, then this is what we're proud of.
Besides, he says, what other option do they have? I'm Eve Troe for Marketplace.
Our series on the BP spill continues online. We've got a map that tracks increases in global crude production over the past 50 years. It's right on our website, marketplace.org.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note on the way out today, Major League Baseball Commissioner Bud Selig announced today he is taking over the Los Angeles Dodgers. The league's going to run the team, Selig said, because of, and this is a quote, my deep concerns regarding the finances and operations of the Dodgers. The team's now former owners, Frank and Jamie McCourt, are in a fight over their divorce. It's a nasty one. The Los Angeles Times reported the other day that Frank McCourt had borrowed $30 million from Fox, that's the team's television partner, so he could make this month's payroll. And that is Marketplace from APM, American Public Media. Today, the Dow gained 186 points, about 1.5%. The NASDAQ surged 57 points, 0.2%. The S&P 500 added 17 points. About 1.3%. Vahan Baladuni, Ravi Karman, Stephen Colon, Bradford Craig, Jeff Peters, and Charlton Thorpe engineer the program for us. You can tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. And coming up next time, back here.
The things you have access to in this movie are remarkable. This film is the movie that, like, the advertising industry and the product placement industry don't want you to see. It's great.
Director Morgan Spurlock on his new documentary, Palm Wonderful, presents the greatest movie ever sold. Like he said, it's about product placement. I'm Kai Rizdal. Do hope you can join us for that tomorrow. This is APM, American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.